rarely scores goals in the second half when his team is winning. You see the point. We can interpret these things, and we have to find meaning in the statistics. And ultimately, the results in 2022 are going to tell us exactly how disastrous or not last week's elections were for Democrats across the country. I hope that you will get instant access to today's bonus show by signing up on my website. You can go to joinpacman.com. We really do depend on your support. We have a staff here. We have, you know, all of these different expenses. We do health care. We do retirement. We do all these different things. And I am able to be a better employer in great part thanks to people who value and support the work that we do. So grab a subscription at joinpacman.com, and we will see you in mere moments.
Yeah, yeah. What's up? This is Total Eclipse.
Word up, Rock Raider from Executioners.
Word up, chilling,
on WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Yeah, yeah. 88.3.
Check it out, all right?
Word up. Real hip hop.
Yeah, thanks, man.
You don't even have to hip hop show.
Oh, we do. We do everything.
Yo. There's only 6 degrees of separation, and we know 5 people you know. How much longer did you really think you could avoid strict flow? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. Like this!
WRCT, this is the place that sets the pace for Pittsburgh.
It's Hovland, you're listening to 88.3 WRCT FM. Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation. Please stay tuned for more incredible tracks from our extensive, vast, libidinous, and...
balls.
Awesome. I called it libidinous. That doesn't make any... I mean...
WRCT Pittsburgh. Automation is the key. I am Dr. Jazz P.
This is Ziggy Marley, and you're listening to WRCT in Pittsburgh, you know? Go Steelers.
We'll give you total control over our lives. Everyone shuts the hell up.
We're Hydra! WRCT! Pittsburgh!
You're listening to WRCT, friends of the FCC. Good friends, good times, and eggnog.
WRCT Pittsburgh. We love monkeys.
Sure.
All right. Yeah.
Are we still taping?
Yeah. Sure. Go right ahead.
We're live. We're not taping.
Oh, we're live.
No,
okay.
We're taping.
We're taping. Okay. They want me to do a little promo. And what do I do? I say, WRCT. Is that it?
WRCT Pittsburgh. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Hello and speedy delivery. This is Mr. McFeely from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and I'm in Pittsburgh. I always listen to WRCT right here in Pittsburgh. Speedy delivery to you.
Top Dog in Pittsburgh, WRCT.
Hey, this is Marlon Saunders, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
This is Brad Yoder, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hello, I'm Meg Lee Chin, and when I'm in town, I like to listen to WRCT 88.3 FM.
WRCT is the best place to be. He sends the music out your way 40 hours every day.
This is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey, this is Steve Archer.
And Donna Lynch.
From Ego Likeness, you're listening to WRCT Radio.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
It's been a long time since you've touched the hand and the heart of that special someone. You're not alone. This is WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation Service. Stay tuned for more tracks from our radio and record library.
Hi, you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, home of... Oh, crap. We're not really home of anything, are we?
WRCT Pittsburgh. No one is as excited about flaming cheese as we are.
Hey, we're the 1985, and whenever we're in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, we like to pick up 13-year-old runaways at the Greyhound station and listen to WRCT! Woo!
Hi, we are Microwaves. Reminding you that the most important things in life are to crush your enemies,
to see them driven before you,
and to hear the lamentations of their women while listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It's immoral for the rich to talk about their future children and grandchildren when the children of the Global South are dying now. We needed concrete solidarity and cooperation. The rich offered more empty words. You're not keeping 1.5 alive. You're setting us on a pathway to 2.5 degrees. You're setting the planet on fire and claiming to act.
The UN Climate Summit in Glasgow has ended with almost 200 nations supporting a watered-down pact that many say fails to address the climate emergency. Summit organizers are blaming India and China. But what role did the United States play behind the scenes? We'll get the latest and speak with an indigenous leader from the Ecuadorian Amazon who attended Glasgow.
The Sacred Headwaters Initiative is proposing a permanent protection of the Sacred Headwaters region. We have said no more oil drilling. Leave fossil fuels in the ground. No more mining. We don't want more logging. We don't want more extraction. This is basically a call for humanity to stop the destruction and permanently protect this important area.
Plus, we'll speak with the Reverend William Barber about the trial of three white men in Georgia who killed Ahmaud Arbery, the black jogger. Last week, a lawyer for one of the men said black pastors in the courtroom are intimidating the jury.
Obviously, there's only so many pastors they can have. And if their pastor's Al Sharpton right now, that's fine. But then that's it. We don't want any more black pastors coming in here. Or other Jesse Jackson, whoever was in here earlier this week, sitting with the victim's family, trying to influence a jury in this case.
Black pastors plan to march outside the Glynn County Courthouse on Thursday. We'll speak with Reverend Barber. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The UN Climate Summit wrapped up in Glasgow, Scotland, Saturday with a significantly weakened deal that activists, scientists, and many governments say falls far short of what's needed to avert a climate catastrophe. COP26 President Alok Sharma praised the deal as historic, but also apologized for last-minute changes that saw earlier drafts of the deal watered down to change the phasing out of coal to phasing down. Based on current government pledges, global temperatures are on track to rise a disastrous 2.4 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels this century. Delegates from poorer nations and those at highest risk from climate change expressed deep disappointment in the outcome of the summit. This is Tina Stege, the climate envoy of the Marshall Islands.
We accept this change with the greatest reluctance. We do so only, and I really want to stress, only because there are critical elements of this package that people in my country need as a lifeline for their future. Thank you.
The most affected nations also slammed the final agreement for failing to sufficiently address loss and damage reparations. This is the Bangladeshi climate scientist Salimul Haq.
It's a death sentence for the poorest people on the planet. And not only that, the polluters are saying, to hell with you. We don't care. We're not going to give you a penny. we'll bring it up again. We're not giving up. But we are describing this COP as an abject failure because it hasn't been able to rise to the occasion of dealing with loss and damage. It doesn't matter what else they do. That was our issue. The poor countries, the vulnerable countries came here for that, and they've been slapped in the face.
Meanwhile, protests continued in Glasgow through the weekend. On Saturday, Extinction Rebellion activists staged a funeral ceremony for all the failed COP summits to date. We'll have more on the outcome of the COP26 after headlines. The U.S. military killed dozens of civilians in an airstrike in Syria in March 2019, then spent the next 2.5 years covering up evidence of war crimes. That's according to a New York Times investigation, which found the death toll from a U.S. strike near the town of Baghouz was almost immediately apparent to military officials, with one legal officer flagging the attack as a possible war crime. But the bombing, which was carried out by a classified special operations unit known as Task Force 9, was never investigated, even though it left about 70 women and children dead. The Times found U.S. military officials downplayed the death toll, delayed reports, and sanitized and classified evidence of civilian deaths. U.S.-led coalition forces bulldozed the blast site, and top military leaders were not notified. COVID-19 continues to surge in Europe, which recorded nearly 2 million coronavirus cases last week, the highest weekly caseload since the start of the pandemic. The World Health Organization says Europe's once again the epicenter of the pandemic as officials blame lagging vaccination rates tied to misinformation for the latest wave. Austria has imposed a lockdown for the roughly 2 million people who've not been fully vaccinated, while the Netherlands is in a partial lockdown with restaurants, supermarkets and shops ordered to close early. Cases in Germany remain at an all-time high as authorities consider new restrictions to help ease the surge. Here in the United States, COVID-19 cases and deaths are rising in at least 29 states. Hospitalizations are also increasing in nearly half of all states. Public health experts warn the U.S. could face a new surge as winter weather and the holidays drive more people to gather indoors. Meanwhile, the Pentagon says it would respond after the newly appointed commander of the Oklahoma National Guard said none of the state's 10,000 Guard members would be required to get vaccinated against COVID, defying a vaccine mandate ordered by U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. In Sudan, at least 8 people were killed, many others wounded Saturday after soldiers fired tear gas and live rounds at thousands of protesters who'd gathered to demand a reversal of the October 25th coup. Among the dead was a 15-year-old who died from bullet wounds to the stomach. This is a protester at Saturday's rally in Khartoum who showed spent shell casings to reporters as gunfire rang out.
The revolutionary protesters have nothing but peacefulness and are calling for democracy and bringing back civilian rule, which was taken away by General Burhan. As you hear now, the sound of live shots is getting louder. These are live shots that they use to target the revolutionaries.
Al Jazeera's Khartoum bureau chief, El-Masami Al-Kabashi, was taken into custody after Sudanese security forces raided his home overnight Saturday. Al Jazeera blasted his arrest as an attack on press freedom and called on international human rights and media groups to condemn Sudan's crackdown. In Spain, Coast Guard sailors discovered the dead bodies of 8 people in a boat transporting migrants and refugees. 62 other passengers were rescued from the vessel, which had been drifting near the Canary Islands for a week. Authorities said the deceased migrants came from unspecified African nations. In Burma, U.S. journalist Danny Fenster has been released from prison just 3 days after he was sentenced to 11 years behind bars by a military court. The English-language news site he writes for, Frontier Myanmar, said Fenster has since left Burma. Former U.S. politician and ambassador to the U.N., Bill Richardson, said he negotiated Fenster's release with Burma's military coup leader. In Afghanistan, journalist Hamid Serrani was killed after a bomb attached to a vehicle exploded in a Kabul suburb Sunday. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attack, which took place in a suburb of mostly Shia Hazara residents. This came one day after at least 3 people were killed in a bomb blast at a mosque in Nangarhar. Members of the Shia community are calling on the Taliban to ensure their protection after a recent spate of deadly attacks.
Afghanistan is still facing problems, and the security has to be maintained. And this is one of the main responsibilities of the ruling government, to provide comprehensive security for all the residents.
In related news, Indian officials are accusing Pakistan of blocking a request to allow 50,000 tons of wheat and medicine to be transported to Afghanistan. The nation's humanitarian crisis, already dire due to war and drought, has deepened since the Taliban takeover in August, with 23 million people facing acute food insecurity and 9 million people on the brink of starvation, this according to the UN. In India, New Delhi schools have closed for 1 week amidst spiking levels of toxic pollution. Air quality in the Indian capital has been further exacerbated by the widespread burning of crop residue. Farmers say they've been left with no other choice but to burn the agricultural stubble to prepare for more cultivation.
The prices of crops are decreasing. The farmers are helpless, and hence they have to burn it. The government should provide some solution, give us subsidies and machinery, or some organization should provide us with machinery to decompose it. There won't be a need for farmers to burn it then. They won't do it.
In Ecuador, at least 68 people were killed during the latest outbreak of deadly prison violence at the Litoral Penitentiary, located in the port city of Guayaquil. In late September, at least 118 people were killed in gang-related fighting at the same prison. Prisons in Ecuador suffer from major overcrowding. Grieving relatives of the killed prisoners are demanding the government do more to prevent such tragedies.
The state and the police should do something. It's not fair that innocent people die. My nephew was not a killer. He was inside for stealing a mobile phone. Do you think that a person deserves to die in this way for stealing a mobile phone?
Back in the United States, Steve Bannon's expected to surrender to authorities today after a federal grand jury charged Bannon with two counts of contempt of Congress Friday for refusing to comply with a subpoena from the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. Meanwhile, former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows did not show up for his deposition before the House Select Committee Friday, which could result in another contempt charge and further action to enforce the subpoena. President Biden's nominated former Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Robert Califf to reprise his role. Califf led the agency for just under a year, starting in 2016. He was previously confirmed with bipartisan support, but has faced opposition from some lawmakers and others over his work consulting for pharmaceutical companies. After leaving the FDA, he started working as an advisor for Google Health and Verily, both owned by Google's parent company, Alphabet. In Kenosha, Wisconsin, lawyers are delivering closing arguments today in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, the white teenage gunman who fatally shot two people and wounded a third during racial justice protests in 2020. Last week, Judge Bruce Schrader garnered yet more scrutiny and outcry after he called on the courtroom to applaud the service of a military member on Veterans Day. That military member was also a witness in the case, leading to concerns of possible jury bias, as he called for the jury to applaud a defense witness. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers has called 500 National Guard troops to be on standby ahead of a possible verdict. And a 9-year-old boy has become the latest and youngest deadly victim of the Astroworld Festival tragedy in Houston, Texas. Ezra Blount had been placed in a medically induced coma after he fell from his father's shoulders during the crowd surge which took place as headliner Travis Scott was performing. 10 people have died from the stampede. The young boy's families filed a lawsuit, one of almost 100 lawsuits that have been filed since the fatal event against Travis Scott, Live Nation, and others. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Climate Countdown. The UN Climate Summit ended Saturday as close to 200 nations agreed to a watered-down deal to address the climate emergency. COP26 President Alok Sharma praised the deal as historic.
But I'm very pleased to say that we now have in place the Glasgow Climate Pact, agreed amongst all the parties here. I would say, however, that this is a fragile win. And we have kept 1.5 alive. That was our overarching objective when we set off on this journey 2 years ago, taking on the role of the COP presidency designate. but I would still say that the pulse of 1.5 is weak. And that's why, whilst we have reached, I do believe, a historic agreement, what this will be judged on is not just the fact that countries have signed up, but it will be judged on whether they meet and deliver on the commitments.
Earlier drafts of the deal called for coal to be, quote, phased out. But in the final agreement, nations agreed for it to be, quote, phased down. Countries also agreed to meet next year to make new pledges to cut carbon. Based on current pledges, global temperatures are on track to rise 2.4 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The Glasgow Pact also calls on wealthy nations to double the amount of money it provides developing nations to help them adapt to the climate crisis that they largely did not cause. While conference leaders described the deal as a historic one, there was a sense of deep disappointment among many nation scientists and activists over the final deal. Asad Rehman addressed the closing plenary on behalf of the COP26 coalition, which had organized last weekend's major climate justice rally in Glasgow.
I'm finding it difficult to convey our anger and frustration at this utter betrayal of people. Hollow words about climate emergency from the richest countries, an utter disregard of the science and equity, false ambition and disdain for justice, a license to pollute with net zero 2050 and carbon markets. You have made decisions, as one party acknowledged, decisions about life and death for millions. Yet 500 years of colonial rule and white supremacy, looting the wealth of the global south, and you still value your profits over the lives of black, brown and indigenous people. The rich have refused to do their fair share. More empty words on climate finance. You've turned your backs on the poorest, who face a crisis of COVID, economic and climate apartheid because of the actions of the richest. It's immoral for the rich to talk about their future children and grandchildren when the children of the global south are dying now. We needed concrete solidarity and cooperation. The rich offered more empty words. You're not keeping 1.5 alive. You're setting us on a pathway to 2.5 degrees. You're setting the planet on fire and claiming to act. Your greenwashing kills, and no amount of spinning will mask that. But we are not without hope. It just will not rest with you, but with us, and we don't compromise on justice.
Asad Rehman of the COP26 Coalition speaking at the closing plenary of the UN Climate Summit Saturday. We're joined now by two guests. Brandon Wu is with us, Director of Policy and Campaigns at ActionAid USA. Just wrote a piece headlined Fossil Fuels in the COP Decision Text, Why the U.S., Not India, is the Problem. And we're joined by Mitzi Tan, a Filipina climate justice activist who was in Glasgow but is now in the Netherlands, headed back to the Philippines. She's a spokesperson for Youth Advocates for Climate Action Philippines and an organizer of Fridays for Future. Mitzi, let's begin with you. Your response to this summit?
Honestly, as Asad Rehman mentioned, this summit was betrayal. It is painful for me knowing that the Philippines is such a vulnerable country for the climate crisis, and that we know that we are hit year after year, month after month with climate impacts, and all the world leaders are talking about are 5 to 10 years from now. All they're doing is pointing fingers at the global south countries, erasing the accountability that they have in historical exploitation and ongoing exploitation of the global north. There has been no real progress in terms of loss and damages and climate finance and adaptation, and also definitely none in terms of drastic carbon dioxide emission cuts, as we see that there is a strong focus on carbon offsetting, which is really just an excuse to keep business as usual, to keep polluting and to keep killing people today.
So can you talk about who actually shaped this agreement? I mean, activists who could get to Glasgow, many say it was the whitest and most privileged summit because you had, of course, vaccine apartheid and this in the midst of the pandemic. But who is this serving and who is this condemning in terms of condemning to catastrophe?
It's funny and ironic, actually, that on the COP26 website, they said they were aiming this to be the most inclusive COP ever. And I think this might have been the most exclusive one, aside from having all those difficulties and objections and obstacles to actually get to Glasgow. When we get there, COVID was used as an excuse to not let observers come into the important negotiations, yet the fossil fuel industry, the fossil fuel lobbyists with over 500 delegates, which is more than any other country, was always welcome, was always given the platform, was always given space. And so you can really see that once again, the UN Climate Summit just prioritized the voices of the privileged and not those that are most affected by the climate crisis.
So this whole issue of coal, instead of phasing out, phasing down, you're going back to the Philippines, you're home. Can you talk about the role of the banks, for example, Standard Chartered Bank funding fossil fuel companies in the Philippines and beyond, as you always have this global focus?
I definitely think that all countries at this space, at this phase, should be phasing out the fossil fuel industry. And that doesn't just stop with coal, but also oil and gas, which the US and the UK conveniently took out of the text while putting all the blame on India, the phase down, by calling it phase down instead of phase out. But it gets rid of the accountability that when we're phasing out the fossil fuel industry, there has to be reparations from the global north countries who are historically responsible, so that countries in the global south, like the Philippines, are able to adapt and transition without having that burden of going into debt to these global north countries and banks like Standard Chartered Bank, which is the greatest funder of fossil fuels in the Philippines. They also fund Adani in India, and they also fund fossil fuel companies in Indonesia. And these banks, they should be the ones who are, instead of funding the fossil fuel industry, but really supporting the transition in our countries, not just for renewable energy, but also for adaptation and to help minimize the loss and damages to their markets also.
I want to go back to COP26 President Alok Sharma. He blamed India and China for watering down the text on coal.
For the very first time in any of these conferences, the word coal is actually reflected in the text. That, again, is a first. Yes, of course, I would have liked to ensure that we maintained the phase out and rather than changing the wording to phase down. But, you know, on the way to phasing out, you've got to phase down. But ultimately, of course, what we need to ensure is that we continue to work on this deal, on the commitments. And on the issue of coal, China and India, of course, are going to have to justify to some of the most climate vulnerable countries what happened.
Brandon Wu's response, Director of Policy and Campaigns at ActionAid USA. You wrote this piece, Fossil Fuels in the COP Decision Text, Why the U.S., Not India, is the Problem. So your response?
I find that statement from Alok Sharma just absolutely outrageous, to point the finger at India and China at the time when the United States, in 2 days, is about to open the largest lease sale for offshore oil and gas drilling in the Gulf of Mexico in the country's history. I mean, let's look at the real climate criminals here. And if you look at that decision text that talks about phasing down coal, it talks about phasing down, quote, unabated coal. And it doesn't mention oil and gas at all. It leaves open these enormous loopholes, again, for the oil and gas industries, particularly in rich countries, and for potentially public financing for things like carbon capture and storage, or what might be called abated coal. And those are technologies that, well, we know they don't work, but they're also incredibly expensive at scale and so only really accessible to rich countries. And it's interesting that a couple of days before that closing plenary, India actually suggested stronger text on fossil fuel phase down or phase out that would cover all fossil fuels in an equitable manner. And that last bit is the key part, because it would mean that rich countries have to take action fastest and first, as we all know would be the globally just thing to do. But for the history of the UN climate negotiations, the United States has always been opposed to equity in that way. And so that stronger text was basically doomed from the start because of US opposition. And so instead, we got some finger pointing at the end towards India, but I would argue they're really not who we should be focusing on. The real climate criminals are the wealthy countries like the United States that are trying to look like heroes, scapegoating others, and still planning massive oil and gas expansions behind everybody's back.
President Biden is going to be signing the bipartisan infrastructure bill today. A lot of the media is completely focused on the rising gas prices and saying that it's partly the reason why Biden is at an all-time low in popularity. What should he do about this, Brad?
I would argue that the reason that Biden is not popular right now is because his administration and the Democratic trifecta have not delivered anything concrete for the American people in terms of the infrastructure package that our country really needs, right? So the original Build Back Better agenda was $3.5 trillion. We knew that that wasn't enough. And instead, all we got was this bipartisan deal, which was watered down drastically even from that. And so what we need is that full Build Back Better agenda as a stepping stone to something even more. There is actual climate legislation in that package. That is the stepping stone we need. That's not anywhere close to the U.S. fair share of climate action globally. That is not global justice in itself, right, if we pass that full agenda. But that is something that would actually deliver meaningful and immediate benefits to the people of this country. And that is what this administration needs to get its popularity up.
Supposedly, they're setting Friday to have a vote on the Build Back Better portion of the infrastructure bill, the social safety net infrastructure. But I wanted to get your comment on John Kerry's comments, the U.S. climate envoy responding to the Glasgow Pact Saturday.
So I would say that, Paris built the arena and Glasgow starts the race. And tonight the starting gun was fired. And we have about 9 years within which to make those critical decisions we were warned about in 2018 by the IPCC. And we have the years in this decade, the decisive decade, in order to cut 45% of global emissions to hold on to the 1.5.
Kerry was Secretary of State at the Paris Agreement under Obama. Your response, Brandon Wu?
That Glasgow was the starting gun of climate action just erases 2.5 decades of rich country inaction. We've been at these negotiations for 26 years. And for 26 years, wealthy countries like the United States have failed to reduce our emissions, even though we know that's what we must do to avert the worst impacts of the climate crisis. And so what Kerry is doing by saying this is the starting gun right now, we have 10 years starting now, is he's erasing history. He's erasing a history of climate colonialism in which the United States is the primary culprit.
And can you talk about this night's virtual summit that's planned between the Chinese leader and the U.S. leader, between Biden and Xi, and what you want to see happen?
I want to see cooperation. I want to see solidarity. I want to see the United States making clear that we are actually willing to take steps to do our fair share. And I'm talking specifically about climate here, right? I think U.S.-China cooperation, these are two major economies. There's so much saber-rattling and xenophobia in the discourse among U.S. politicians about China. And if the Biden administration can actually, diplomatically engage with China in a responsible way, that can only be a positive step. But we have to be able to come forward with real commitments that are, appropriate to our fair share as the world's largest carbon polluter, as the world's massive military superpower. And we cannot just continue to engage in, we can't continue to see China as an adversary, right? Not just an economic adversary, but a security threat is the way that China is being framed by a lot of American politicians, and that's incredibly dangerous.
We're going to end with Mitzi Tan. Mitzi, you're in the Netherlands. You're heading back to the Philippines, where climate now is usually right around. I mean, this was early for the climate summit. It's always devastating the Philippines at around this time. You're a spokesperson for International Youth Advocates for Climate Action Philippines. What are your plans for this year? Next year, the COP is supposed to be in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. What are your plans for this year? How do you get these COPs not to fail every year?
It's an interesting climate summit that will be happening next year in a country where striking and protesting is not exactly very welcome. But it can be sure that the youth will continue to mobilize because we understand that changes will not happen within this UN climate summit, because these summits are also just a product of the imperialist, colonialist, profit-oriented system that we're in today. And in order to get rid of the climate crisis, we have to get rid of the system that has brought this upon us. And that is only going to happen as long as the people keep uniting, showing solidarity, and coming out together on the streets in whatever way we can to fight for climate justice. And that is exactly what the youth climate movement will have for the next year, for the year after that, day after day, month after month. We will keep connecting with the most marginalized sectors of society and amplifying the voices of our environmental defenders. And that is what is all that is needed. That is collaboration, coalition, and unity, something that our world leaders should be doing but aren't doing right now.
Mitzi Tan, we want to thank you for being with us, Filipina climate justice advocate, international spokesperson for youth activists for Youth Advocates for Climate Action Philippines, organizer with Fridays for Future and Fridays for Future Most Affected Peoples and Areas, speaking to us from the Netherlands, and Brandon Wu, director of policy and campaigns, ActionAid USA. Will link to your piece, Fossil Fuels, in the COP decision text, Why the U.S., Not India, Is the Problem. Next up, we speak to an indigenous leader from the Ecuadorian Amazon who attended Glasgow, and then the Reverend William Barber, why scores of black pastors are headed to Georgia as one of the defense attorneys in the Ahmaud Arbery case, the trial of the three white men who murdered the black jogger, why this defense lawyer said black pastors in the courtroom intimidate the jury. Stay with us. Arca by Nicola Cruz. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. This is Climate Countdown. I'm Amy Goodman. Indigenous activists led a number of protests last week in Glasgow, calling on wealthy nations and big banks to address the climate emergency and to preserve the Amazon. On Wednesday, indigenous activists protested at the Glasgow headquarters of J.P. Morgan Chase to push the bank to halt funding for oil and gas extraction. While the protest was going on, we spoke to Domingo Paez inside the UN Climate Summit. He is an Achuar leader from Ecuador and Territories Coordinator for the Amazon Sacred Headwaters Initiative for the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of the Ecuadorian Amazon, which represents some 11 indigenous nationalities from the Amazon. We also spoke to Atosa Saltani. She's Director of Global Strategy for the Amazon Sacred Headwaters Initiative, also founder of Amazon Watch. I began by asking Atosa about why she was in Glasgow.
I'm here in an unprecedented moment for Indigenous participation in the climate summit here in Glasgow. The Indigenous people here have been very vocal, visible, and bringing their concerns from the heart of the Amazon basin, from all over the world, but in particular the Amazon basin. Their demands are clear, that governments need to halt policies, economic policies, and extractive industries that affect the forest, that we cannot win the battle against climate unless we protect the world's remaining rainforest. The Amazon, the largest rainforest on the planet, is key to addressing climate stability. The Amazon is reaching a tipping point of ecological collapse, and we're here to sound the alarm bells that action is needed now, no more talking, not just talking about how we reduce emissions, emissions, but we have to stop producing so much fossil fuels. The fact that fossil fuel production is still on the rise and that, you know, there's not been a moratorium. The indigenous peoples here are demanding that there be a moratorium on fossil fuel extraction and that banks and financial institutions stop financing the activities that are basically increasing emissions instead of reducing emissions. Basically, the more we increase the supply, the more we're going to increase the emissions. And so that's one key demand. Also, indigenous peoples are calling for participation in solutions that affect their territories. Indigenous peoples are the guardians of 50% of the world's intact forests and 80% of the world's biodiversity. Their territories are the best safeguards we have against climate catastrophe. And they're under attack, and even indigenous peoples are being brutally murdered, assassinated, prosecuted, and put in jail for defending their forests. We're here to bring solutions and amplify indigenous voices for systemic and true solutions, not offsets, not net zero, not things that just create, funny accounting. Instead, we want real reductions. We want indigenous rights to be respected, indigenous peoples to have a voice in the negotiations and in the solutions that affect their territories. And we want the biological systems of the planet to be at the center. Protection of the biological systems of the planet are key to addressing climate change.
And if you can talk about the area of Ecuador and Peru that we're talking about, this 86 million acres of rainforest, one of the most biologically diverse ecosystems on Earth.
Yeah, so, you know, the Amazon basin is not only the lungs of the Earth, as we've often heard, but it's also the heart of the planet in the way that the Amazon rainforest recycles rain and generates atmospheric rivers that are responsible for basically rainfall not only in the continent of South America, but all around the world. And that cycling of water is dependent on forests. And the more forests are cut down, the more that system of recirculating of the atmospheric rivers is on the verge of collapse. We are at tipping point, basically. And, every tree, every acre of forest that's lost, we are getting basically the windows closing for making a difference in the future of the Amazon. So within that context, indigenous peoples from all over the Amazon have called for a permanent protection of 80% of the Amazon by 2025. And that is a campaign that's being launched. It's backed by scientific evidence of that's what the Amazon needs to maintain its vital cycles of the hydroclimatic system. And within that, the Sacred Headwaters is an area the size of Oregon that's at the headwaters of the Amazon, at the source of this mighty river. What happens there affects downstream the rest of the forest. And here, about majority of this forest is threatened by oil and mining and logging, also infrastructure, dams, roads, and agriculture. So indigenous peoples representing 30 nations have come together to call for the permanent protection of this forest and to really call for a transition, an ecological transition that puts life at the center of all economic and governance decisions. They've developed a bioregional plan, and hopefully Domingo will tell you more about it. This plan really contemplates an end to extractive industries, an end to the extractive economy, and the dawn of a new economic model that's based on forest and people flourishing, a just economic, ecologic transition.
If you could introduce Domingo Páez to us, I have introduced him as an Achuar leader from Ecuador, but if you could go broader, the context, and then ask him to talk about why he's in Glasgow, if you wouldn't mind translating for us.
Domingo Páez Napichkai is an Achuar leader from Ecuador. He's been a tireless advocate for indigenous rights. He's been a historic leader. I've known him since 2000. He's held many different positions in the indigenous movement. And currently, he's one of the main organizers that has united the indigenous nations of the Sacred Headwaters region and has been tirelessly advocating for land rights, for basically a new model of economic development based on buen vivir, or well-being, and is incredibly inspiring. I'm really happy he's here with us today, and I can invite him to say a few words.
Domingo, ¿puedes explicar por qué estás aquí, por qué venías aquí en Casco? Y yo voy a traducir, por favor.
Buenas tardes.
Good afternoon. It is great to be here, and I want to thank this medium and also the people of Glasgow for coming here, for listening to us, for giving me an opportunity to say why I'm here, why we've come here to defend the forest. I'm here because all of the governments of the world have gathered in this COP26, and they're talking about addressing climate crisis. I'm here representing the indigenous nations of Ecuador and Peru. We have brought a proposal, a solution to climate change, from our territories in the Ecuadorian Peruvian Amazon. That's called the Sacred Headwaters. I'm also here to seek allies, to look for allies, because the problems of climate change are basically driving humanity towards the brink. These are serious problems, and it's going to take alliances with indigenous peoples and the rest of society to address them. The Amazon is key to solving the future crisis facing humanity, and that's why I'm here looking for allies. It's going to take all of us, all walks of life, all sectors of society, to come together to be united, to seek solutions that are for the interests of the common good for all of humanity, and that's why I'm here. The Sacred Headwaters Initiative is proposing a permanent protection of the Sacred Headwaters region. We have said no more oil drilling, leave fossil fuels in the ground, no more mining. We don't want more logging. We don't want more extraction. This is basically a call for humanity to stop the destruction and permanently protect this important area. And this area of the Amazon is incredibly important. Biologically, it's where 30 indigenous nations have come together and said enough is enough. We don't want extractive industries. We don't want more oil drilling. We have to protect this area. There are 30 indigenous nations and 30 million hectares of intact forests that are at stake. We must protect this for all of the creatures that are here, not only animals, the visible creatures that we see, but also for the invisible. The forest is calling on us that we have to do this ecological transition, that we cannot continue the path that we've been. Let's put a pause on history. Let's not blame people for the history of what's happened in the past. Let's move forward and construct a new path forward that addresses the critical condition that humanity finds itself in. We have to, all of us have to, work together. Young people, old people, women, men, every sector of society, government, we must work together for our common future. And it is that transition, ecological transition, is what we're seeking. And that work begins within ourselves. We must first change our relationship to nature, change the way we think about the world, and really put at the center of our thinking our connection to life and our commitment to future generations.
I want to thank Domingo Paez for speaking with us. Does he have one last message that he wants to share?
¿Quieres un mensaje último para terminar?
Sí. Yo invito a toda la humanidad. Ahora no hay otro camino. Invito a que depongamos nuestro...
So, I want to make an invitation. I call on everyone, all walks of life. I want everyone to unite and find our shared future, a common future. We have to stop resisting change. We have to stop resisting one another. Special interests have to fall away. We have to unite for the common future because there's no way to move forward in this moment in time. I want to call on young people. I want to call on men and women to come together and search for solutions together. It is not going to be the way of the past. It's not what we've done in the past isn't going to work. We must construct new paths based on ecological consciousness and a love of humanity, and a path that is about our common future.
Well, Domingo Paez, I want to thank you for being with us, our leader from Ecuador. And finally, as you race off to the airport, Atossa Soltani, if you can speak specifically about the banks, the protests that have been taking place most recently, on Wednesday, the indigenous leaders demanding J.P. Morgan Chase halt fossil fuel financing. And overall, the other banks as well, like the new commitment from the Dutch bank ING, announcing they are the latest bank to commit to ending new oil financing. They're continuing with old financing. But what this all means, what these banks are responsible for.
Amy, in order to address the goals of the 1.5 degrees of the Paris Agreement, and in order to stop the collapse of the biosphere and the tipping point of the Amazon, we need fossil fuel future, free future. We need banks to divest from fossil fuels. The fact is that the current Paris Agreement doesn't even address the word fossil fuels in its agreement. We are not regulating or restraining production. We're only talking about emissions. Meanwhile, what's currently in the pipeline for banks to be financing, you know, what's in the process of being permitted by countries and financed by the banks in Europe and in North America is enough to send us way over the 1.5 degrees. So what we need is to basically commit to a fossil fuel moratorium, a fossil free non-proliferation treaty. And I know that the campaigners here for that movement are having a press conference to announce what that is, you know, where that effort can go. But meanwhile, banks need to make a commitment. There's an Amazon exclusion policy. You can check it out on Amazon Watch's website that calls for banks to end their financing to fossil fuels. We cannot be filling the bathtub at the same time as talking about offsets and emissions while we're continuing to put emissions in the air. And we need absolute reductions. And that has to start with stopping production.
Atossa Sultani, Director of Global Strategy for the Amazon Sacred Headwaters Initiative, also the founder of Amazon Watch, and Domingo Paez, Achuar leader from Ecuador and Territories Coordinator for the Amazon Sacred Headwaters Initiative. They were both in Glasgow for the summit. When we come back, the Reverend William Barber will talk about the trial of the three white men in Georgia who are on trial for the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, the black jogger. Last week, a lawyer for one of the men said black pastors in the courtroom are intimidating the jury. Stay with us.
Where does hate come from? And how can we make it stop? Got to make some changes before somebody else gets shot. We need to pay attention to all the helpless cries. We gotta stop the madness before another life goes by. For decades, we keep treating people wrong. Why does doing something right take so long?
Another Life Goes by Christone Kingfish Ingram. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn now to Georgia, where the trial of the three white men who hunted down and shot dead Ahmaud Arbery took an unexpected twist last Thursday when a defense attorney claimed the courtroom presence of high-profile black pastors sitting with the Arbery family could be intimidating for the jury, which is almost all white. In a minute, we'll be joined by the Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign, one of those pastors who visited the courthouse last week. But first, this is defense attorney Kevin Goh, who represents William Roddy Bryan, neighbor of Gregory McMichael and his son Travis McMichael, who chased and killed Arbery.
Your Honor, I was reminded of one matter that I wanted to address. My understanding while I was cross-examining Investigator Lowry yesterday is that the Right Reverend Al Sharpton managed to find his way into the back of the courtroom. I'm guessing he was somehow there at the invitation of the victim's family in this case. And I have nothing personally against Mr. Sharpton. My concern is that
It's one thing for the family to be present. It's another thing to ask for the lawyers to be present. But if we're going to start a precedent starting yesterday, we're going to bring high-profile members of the African-American community into the courtroom to sit with the family during the trial in the presence of the jury. I believe that's intimidating, and it's an attempt to pressure. Could be, consciously or unconsciously, an attempt to pressure or influence the jury.
In a statement, the Reverend Al Sharpton said the attorney's comments, quote, underscore the disregard for the value of the human life lost and the grieving of a family in need of spiritual and community support, unquote. On Friday, Attorney Goh made a brief apology in court, calling his comments overly broad, said he would follow up today with a, quote, more specific motion. Meanwhile, more than 100 black pastors say they plan to come to the Glynn County Superior Courthouse this Thursday to help pray for the family of Ahmaud Arbery. Sharpton has said he was invited to Brunswick by Arbery's parents and raised concerns about the makeup of the jury. Sharpton has called the killing a lynching in the 21st century. This is Ahmaud Arbery's father, Marcus Arbery, speaking last week.
That's why I know my boy ain't take nothing. Right. My boy got killed because of skin color. Lynch. All right.
Go to the Reverend Dr. William Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, president of Repairers of the Breach. He just returned from Brunswick, Georgia, where he visited with the community and family of Ahmaud Arbery, was in court last week. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you respond to the lawyer saying black pastors in the courtroom intimidate the jury?
Amy, first of all, let me thank you, and let me just say, reach out and pray for the Ahmaud Arbery family. You know, I was invited to come down as well as also from the family as a part of Transformative Justice Network. And there are many ministers that are part of this. First thing I want to say is we as ministers have to not resist taking this personally, because it's not about us. It's about this family. And we have to understand in the white supremacist mind what this lawyer is doing. Number one, he doesn't have a case, because his own people filmed their killing this young man. Think about that. They filmed it. This wasn't somebody else. They're the ones that did the filming of this murder, this killing. So I guess they thought they would be celebrated as heroes. Secondly, what he said is instructive. And I'm saying to clergy, be careful that you don't take the bait. It's not about me or Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson. He said he connected black with intimidation. He said black pastors are intimidating. We need to unpack that, because he's sitting in the room with men that tracked, hunted, and destroyed a young man's life, and yet he says black pastors are intimidating. First of all, he also limited black to pastoring black people. Now, I'm not a black pastor. I didn't get consecrated as a black bishop. I was consecrated as a bishop. I was ordained as a pastor, been pastoring 30-some years, white, black, brown, all kinds of people. So we have to resist that. You know, that limits us. We are pastors who happen to be black. But also we've got to unpack this trope that has been used down through history. Black is intimidating, i.e. just being black is a problem. And then when you unpack that, Amy, you can understand the crux and the problem, the centerfold of the racial violence problem in this country, whether it be a racist white cop or like these three men. They saw Brother Arvin, Ahmaud, as being black first, therefore being intimidating, therefore being a problem, therefore being somebody in the wrong place, therefore being somebody that needed to be purged, destroyed, killed, murdered. In essence, they saw black, they saw a nigger, they saw someone to be destroyed. And that's why you see oftentimes a cop kill someone unarmed and not have any remorse. They don't think they've done anything wrong. Or you can have someone shoot somebody who happens to be black or brown, and they don't think they're anything wrong, because that issue of blackness being identified with intimidation. So black lawyers are intimidated. Black pastors are intimidated. It's the issue and the framing. Now, he's trying to clean it up, but you really can't clean it up. And I don't know if I want him to clean it up, because in that moment was a deep, rare honesty. That was a deep honesty. And America needs to hear it and learn from it. And I hope, yes, pastors will go, but go as pastors and go as ministers. And I know I've been asked by some others down there to come next week and lead a group of interfaith ministers. It's ministers, regardless of race, creed, or color, that believe in justice, that believe in right. And so I'm considering that as well. We need to not take this personal. It's not about us. It's about the heart of these cases where blackness, as for years in American history, was identified with intimidation, and therefore the blackness itself is declining.
And the fact that you've got this jury, one black juror, even the judge in the case after jury selection, which took week after week, called it intentional discrimination, but allowed the trial to go on.
Right. But see, they're mostly white, so they're not intimidated. In the mindset, they're not intimidated, and certainly they can't be discriminatory. Now, on the other hand, if it was an all-black jury, or all black but one white, then they would be up and jumping up and down. It's a problem. It's a problem. But see, again, because of how blackness is used and how blackness is seen, if anybody ought to be intimidated in that courtroom, it's that father that has to sit in that courtroom and look at three people who shot his son down like a dog and who filmed it and put it on camera. If anybody should be intimidated, it should be the family looking at that jury pool and not seeing a jury of their peers, of their son's peers. That's who should be intimidated. But instead, we have a rare honesty this morning, the other day. You know, when I was there, after the court closed at 12, we went outside and we had a rally. 50% of the folk at the rally were white. 50% of the folk at the rally were white. We then marched to Ahmaud Arbery's mural, and black and white people knelt together. But all he saw was black pastors intimidated. And then he tried to make a reference to equate a black pastor with somebody with a sheet looking like, and I guess he meant the Ku Klux Klan. So once again, he's that blackness is seen in itself as an extreme, as something extreme in the human reality. And that's what we need to be unpacking this moment, because if we deal with that issue, then you wouldn't have killings like you're having them. You wouldn't have destroying, because people would not automatically, when they see black, see a problem.
We want to talk about why you're in Washington, D.C., but I just want to ask about this moment. You have the trial in Georgia. Then you've got the Rittenhouse case. 500 yeah. state troopers have been called out to deal with the verdict. And you have the judge in that case on Thursday calling on the jurors, the entire courtroom, to applaud a man who was about to testify for the defense because it was Veterans Day and he was a veteran. They had to applaud him. Again, yeah, well, a jury of just one black person.
Yeah. Imagine that judge being a black judge doing that in another case. This judge is just way out of bounds. And remember what they're trying to say about this. I mean, he was out there. He claims he was fearing for his life, even though what was going on wasn't even really near him. And they're trying to basically say he was a hero, he was defending himself, but he was the one with this you know, gun, I think an AK-47. But we've seen it all year. Anybody can ask you, imagine, you ask anybody, imagine three black men riding in a truck killing a young white boy, what would happen? Imagine if all black people had been rushing the Capitol on January 6th. Imagine if this was a black judge doing this in this other case. This is where we are seeing how race plays out. And it's important, even in where I'm in D.C. today. You know, when we look at this Build Back Better plan, think about it. The infrastructure plan, the most of that money is probably going to go to white men and white contractors, so forth and so on. When the money gets sent to the states, those states get to divvy it out. Most of those states are Republican-led states that are also fighting against opportunities to vote. On the other hand, the Build Back Better plan, if you look at the dynamics, who's going to get impacted the most, it will be poor white people and black people and brown people. You take the Build Back Better plan, just take one piece of it, say expanding child tax credit. That's going to impact 35 million households. Now, we know 140 million poor and low-wealth people are in this country, 26 million black, which is 60.9% of black people, and 66 million white, which is 30-some percent of white people. So we know that that bill is going to have an impact on black people, that are poor, white people, poor, brown people, poor. Which bill is getting fought the most? Not the infrastructure. And if you go down to each part of that bill, we've done it. Take, for instance, the expanding of the money for home health care workers. Well, 28% of those persons are black, 23 are Latino. So we're in D.C. today with people from all over the country, black, white, brown, Asian, Native, who are saying we are not going to accept just an infrastructure plan that fixes our roads and our bridges while you leave our bodies, our education, the infrastructure of our daily lives, living wages undone. We can't do that. And we're saying if you oppose the bill, as small as it is, then you also oppose racial equity and you also oppose class equity. And we have to start unpacking these deals.
Reverend Barber, we have to leave it there. We thank you so much for being with us. Co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, president of Repairers of the Breach. And a fond farewell to Miriam Barnard. Such enormous gratitude for all your work over the past decade. Special thank you for helping to keep our team safe on and off-site during the pandemic. Your humor and compassion and skill was so cherished at Democracy Now! You'll be forever a part of our DNA because, after all, you are a Democracy Now! Alum. All the very best. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
RCT in sound from way out.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Dr. William Bronston, the author of the just-published book, Public Hostage, Public Ransom. This is a great book. It exposes the story of Willowbrook, a hellhole on Staten Island that was exposed 50 years ago. Conditions in this asylum, this warehouse, obtains today throughout the United States thanks to Medicaid. Give a listen. We speak with the leading anti-drone activist in the United States, Nick Moturn, from Ban Killer Drones. These killer drones recently killed a family of 10 people in Afghanistan, but they've been operating by Bush, Trump, now Biden, killing people really illegally, indiscriminately across the globe. Give a listen to this.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
In the 1970s, the shocking horrors of Willowbrook State School on Staten Island in New York City were exposed to the entire world. Some 200,000 disabled people live in isolated large public warehouses in every state, segregated from the rest of society and horribly abused and neglected daily. Some 30,000 were living at Willowbrook at the time. Dr. William Bronston worked at the largest one, holding 6,000 incarcerated children and adults. He worked there over a three-year period on the inside. He helped organize the parent community to file a federal class action lawsuit, literally for crimes against humanity, telling the truth about this horrific place, the Willowbrook hellhole. Attorney Richard Levy and I speak with him today. Mistreatment of people with disabilities and elderly persons is facilitated because the mostly private institutions that hold them hostage in every community get massive Medicaid funding. It is a national scandal and a threatening harbinger for all of us. The ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle said, quote, "Life in the community is a necessary condition for a person's complete flourishing as a human being." This is what needs to be done, reintegrating these people into the community. It's the goal today across the USA. Dr. William Branson has just come out with a significant book entitled Public Hostage, Public Ransom, Ending Institutional America. We speak today with Dr. Bronston. We're also joined in this interview by my friend and colleague, Attorney Richard Levy. It was Richard's law firm, Eisner & Levy, who represented Dr. Bronston in a class action against the state of New York. Dr. William Bronson, welcome to Law and Disorder. Do you mind if I call you Bill?
Absolutely, Michael. Thank you so much.
Bill, please tell us something about your background. What made you so political? What kind of education did you get? And what was the political situation like in the country when you were coming up? And what helped shape you at school?
Well, Michael, I grew up in the 60s during the height of the civil rights movement and the struggle against the war in Vietnam, which was, ubiquitous. And I was in medical school, and I was very frustrated at the lack of humanity in the curriculum and became very actively involved in organizing all the medical students in my medical school, the University